My name is Father Gregory Pine, and I'm an assistant director for the Thomistic Institute, and it's my joy to welcome you back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for this most recent off-campus conversation. This time, I'm glad to be joined by Professor Catherine Pakalik. Thanks so much for joining.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Okay, so many listeners of the TI podcast will have heard lectures that you have given on a variety of cool subjects. Some may know you by other means still, by your publications. More on that later. But for those who don't, would you just say a word about who you are, where you're from, what you do?
Sure. So I teach at the Catholic University of America, which is gratefully right across the street from the Dominican House of Studies. So we're over in Brooklyn, Brooklyn in Washington, D.C. Some people call it Little Rome, and I love that. So let's see, I teach in the business school. So I'm an economist by training. And as an economist, I worked on questions related to education, economics of education, models of education. That's one of the ways I first encountered Edith Stein's work. But anyway, so people know me over there as, you know, somebody who teaches economics. And then I teach some other courses related to that, you know, economics of education, family studies, demography, things like that. I also live in Maryland with my husband, who's a philosopher and sometimes does work with the TI as well. And then we've got a nice house full of kids.
When you say a nice house full of kids, sometimes people say house full of kids and they're like, we have three kids. Sometimes people say we have a house full of kids and we have seven kids. If memory serves, do you have between you 15?
We do, between us, 15. But they don't all live in the house at the same time. I don't think all 15 have ever lived in the house at the same time together.
Okay.
So yeah, at the moment, we have four children that are school-aged and still living at home. We have two in college who live at home, but depending on my mood, I count them or I don't count them. They live at home, but they go to Catholic University, one in music and one in engineering. And then the rest are all either married or studying somewhere else.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
At one point, Father Bonaventure was reading the book that describes your husband's late wife and like her life and kind of her holiness. And
right.
It was at that point that I first heard of, you know, like you, your husband, your family. And I was like, holy smokes, these people are special. But short of embarrassing you, we're going to talk about Edith Stein.
Yeah, you are embarrassing me.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Sorry.
That's okay. No,
yeah.
Listen, praise God. I mean, our lives are somewhat mysterious to us, I think. That's kind of all I have to say about it right now. But if at any point the things that kind of God has placed in our path serve as an inspiration to other people, then, you know, praise be to God.
Yeah. I think about often, maybe I repeat this too much. Maybe it's become a trope and not a sincere thought. Regardless, who cares about sincerity? Moving on. I think that like we're living our lives and as we go along, we're interpreting our lives. And I think you get better both at living and at interpreting. And when the two come together, you know, like on Christmas around the family table, like eating cured ham, it's really sweet because by and large, the living part feels like a dumpster fire and the interpreting part feels like walking through a cave.
Yeah. Yes. I think you've got it all nailed. I'm sure they're going to assign you to the young friars, right? To just get all of this inspiration. You're going to be like, guys, it's eating ham at the holidays and it's a dumpster fire and a cave. And they're going to, you're like, take him off. But you're not wrong. And in fact, if we could get to it at some point, actually, I think Edith Stein has something to say about this. She has this comment about what it means to be getting clear about ourselves and that we're not selves that are static. We're selves that are developing. I mean, hopefully, right? We're either getting better or we're getting worse. But the soul isn't meant to be stationary. And she says something like, it's really tough to get clarity in relation to the process because we see that we're becoming. So I don't know if it works with your cave analogy, but yeah, it's really tough to interpret, to live and interpret in the same moment. Possible with grace, but I think it's a struggle.
Yeah. I don't know that I have, I don't have a good image. I've already made that manifest by the fact that I described it as a combo dumpster fire cave walk. But like, certainly it seems as if our lives are unfolding in two axes, you know, and whereas like angels, it seems like their lives are unfolding in one axis, or like animals, it seems like their lives are unfolding in one axis, different axes in the different cases. But there's something just I don't know if I want to say brutal, because it's just human. I think it's to be evaluated on its own terms. There's something very human about a kind of patience with progress, or a kind of patience with ongoing, you know, like revelation and mediation of life. Because certainly it's a temptation to be like, yeah, I don't want to even bother figuring this out. I'm just going to rootle around in my trough and eat whatever swill is afforded to me. Or to say like, I want to have this all figured out yesterday. And until such time as I do, I will foreclose on the possibility of a meaningful life.
that's absolutely right. Or we close it in a box and don't look at it, kind of hope that it'll just go away. Or like next time we open the box, it'll look better. But yeah, it's really humbling. It's humbling to be a person.
it is, provided that one is open to such humbling.
Right.
If not, it's just grind you into the grounding, whatever the gerundia form of that is.
I've been thinking as we're starting Lent how, you know, I pray a lot for humility as a virtue. And I was kind of thinking, well, if you're praying for humility, you kind of have to get ready to be humiliated, right? Like, how are you going to become more humble if you don't? So I've been kind of trying to get my head around, like, why would I be surprised if that's humiliating? That's where I'm at.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's conditioned by the fact that God reveals himself in principally paternal, every once in a while maternal, but nonetheless, you know, like providential terms.
Right.
So it's like we have difficulty reconciling humiliation as life lesson with good parenting. I guess unless you're a parent and then you realize that it's a real possibility / a daily occurrence. But from a certain distance, we're like, no, that can't possibly be the way that you mean to teach me. And then it happens and you're like, yes. Apparently, we're doing this now.
Right.
Okay. So, you speak often about Edith Stein, St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, and you speak about her not as like a kind of curio to be kept in a cabinet, but as a woman who breathes wisdom for a contemporary age. When you first discovered St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, I'll just say that for the most part, because I like preferring saints' names, even if they're less recognizable to a lay audience. When you first discovered her, like, what was it about her that captured your attention? Or what was it about her that kind of spoke to you? Like, this is part of who I am. This is part of what I'm meant to tell.
Yeah. So I first read little passages from the Essays on Women when I was in high school. So I was blessed to have a really great English literature professor at a girls' high school, in fact, near Washington, D.C. I was at Oakcrest. And this teacher of mine, I don't remember exactly the format, if she just shared an essay with us but I read some of those passages about what the soul of a woman was meant to be like. And I remember just thinking, like, this is the coolest thing I've ever read. Like, you're 16 or you're 17 and you're just, some of those things we just shared with each other. But at that age, man, I mean, you just don't know where you're going. My home life was a little bit troubled at the time. I had trouble making friends at the time. Thanks be to God, I don't now. But there were a lot of things that weren't, you know, maybe fulfilling in my life at the time. And I was struggling with that, trying to grow closer to God, but really kind of get an image of what I was meant to be like. I didn't feel like I fit in with my friends in high school very much. I liked to study a lot more than my friends did. And I was sort of serious as a person. And a lot of high school students, actually, I've come to learn a lot of college students aren't that serious. And so I kind of felt like alone in a lot of ways. And I don't want to make this out to be what it wasn't. But when I read Edith Stein, I thought, here's somebody that kind of gets what I'm thinking about. Like, I just thought, like, it clicked. I thought, okay, I want to keep reading this. I liked it so much. I excerpted that quote about the ideal image of the gestalt of the female soul in the whole part, you know, about the soul is meant to be warm and quiet and self-contained. And that whole image, I put it in my yearbook, is like my favorite quote that year. So whatever it was, you know, I'm kind of just trying to look back, and I think self-reflection at such a distance, 30 years now, it's hard to do it. But I'll just say that for me, it was a kind of love at first sight. I mean, when I read this, I thought, this is serious. It's wise. It's not attempting to have all the answers. Like, you read her and you think, man, she's informed so much, but it's also humble. She'll say outright when things are difficult or not so easy for us to see. So that was it for me. I read it as a 16-year-old and thought, I'm not going to ever not read this. Like, this is kind of like a motto or an anthem or something that I'm going to keep consulting. And it really has been that in my life. It's never been cold on the shelf for too long.
There's a sense in which when you read, whether fiction or nonfiction, and an author manages to capture like what you've thought, but never in such coherent fashion. Like right. When an author gives a kind of vocabulary and grammar for the enunciation of emotion, sentiment, feeling, thought, aspiration, hope, and it all comes together and you recognize yourself. And it's kind of like one of those, on the one hand, get out of my head moments. But on the other hand, profoundly consoling moments, because it's like, ah, yes, there is someone who is closer to me than my confusion about life.
Right.
And like at root, that's really what I wanted all along. I said that I wanted answers, and I do want answers. You know, like there's a kind of teleological striving that's at work here. But I really just wanted someone to like be with me without being, you know, too kind of romantic about it. But like someone to be with me in that. Like if someone could truly look me in the eyes and say, I understand, and I could trust that person, that would make all the difference. And I think it's like it's with authors like her.
Yeah.
Or with, you know, like everyone has his or her own. But like, yeah, there's something about that that's so profoundly consoling.
Yes. So my husband sometimes says about why he studied Aristotle, he says something, you know, he'd been a philosophy student for a long time. And when he sort of first started really reading Aristotle in the Greek, which took him a long time to be able to do that and started to really understand, he said it was for him, it was the difference between other philosophers you read because they were interesting or they were important or they had something to teach about how they structured their arguments. He said, but when he read Aristotle, he thought, this is someone you want to think like, this person. And he had this overwhelming thought that the right thing to do in the presence of that kind of a mind would be to try to disciple yourself after this person. And I mean, for him, of course, that evolved. This is, you know, when he was still becoming a Christian and making the faith his own. But I would say that was kind of my reaction to reading Edith Stein as a young person was, I don't want to just know what she said. I want to think like she thinks. And so it was certainly, and you know what, by the way, like, I think it goes in another way too, which if I can be so bold as to say it, maybe you have authors like this for you too. I felt that I really understood her, you know, and not in an expert sense, but I thought like, I don't know, do people feel this way when they first read the gospel? I hope they do, right? They kind of want to run around and say, has anybody even paid attention to this? Like, do you know what she's saying? This is so good and important. And that sense of like, I've just heard really good news. I've met a person that you should meet, which is, I think, how we want to approach a Christian life in general. Like, here's somebody you definitely have to meet. It's going to change your life if you could meet this person. And I do think that authentic holiness, in a saint, somebody who's an intellectual and a saint, that's a special thing, but that ought to be like, that's a natural reaction to holiness. It's like, I've got to share this person and their holiness with you. So I definitely felt that early on. I didn't really have an appreciation for what that looked like in me or would look like later in my life, but I kind of had that thought, like, is anybody else not, you know, like, are you not seeing this? Like, why isn't everybody talking about this? This is the best thing ever. So yeah, whatever that is, maybe that just turns out to be kind of a kind of personal charism. You think like, I got to talk about this person. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I have had a somewhat similar experience. I hesitate to say the same experience because of pertinent differences, but I heard a lecture given by Eleanor Stump my freshman year of college. She was describing Aquinas on the nature of love, and it immediately converted me.
Yeah.
In the sense that I had an experience of human relationships, you know, to that point, mostly superficial, but still, you know, like a kind of intimation of profundity to follow. And then she described love with a kind of precision and clarity. And I was like, holy smokes.
Yeah, right.
I was like, that's whoever saw that and perceived that. I want to think like him. And then I read a book about St. Thomas Aquinas, super charming, one of these historical fiction things that Louis de Waal did called The Quiet Light.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of which I was like, I think I want to love like that. So for me, it was a kind of comprehensive claim. It was like, I want to be like that. Not in the sense like I want to waddle around like a little duckling behind a mama duck and just like ape his movements, but Right. I want to know the Lord and love the Lord in the way in which he knows the Lord and love the Lord, because it has such deep resonance. And I think the only way that I can interpret that resonance is like claim. Yeah.
I'm so hearing what you're saying. It's exactly the kind of thing. And I think for a young person to encounter that kind of a mind, I mean, I had a little bit of an experience similar to that later, although not as direct, when I first read The Apologia by John Henry Newman, at a time when I was really kind of intellectually lost later in college. So there's a diversion that happens later. But I think for a young person to encounter that kind of greatness and holiness, and that the strength of that sort of intellectual virtue, but then to recognize like this is not a person who's passed away, right? There's a person who's very much alive in Christ. And that takes that possibility of encountering in a really, I don't know, in a personal way, right? So to you, like Aquinas's thought and his, that's right, it's not just his thought, right? His description of a possibility, like that you were made for this sort of love, like, and this is real. And his description of this just resonates with you and it reaches in and grabs you, converts you on the spot. That possibility is totally rationalized and like ennobled and made possible by the fact that St. Thomas Aquinas and Edith Stein and John Henry Newman, they're like working and active in our lives. I mean, just think about that for a second. Like the people who are out there idolizing their favorite author or whatever that looks like, they want to reach into that kind of infinity, right? But it's not on offer. But with the saints, it's on offer.
Yeah. I was in a, gosh, where was I? I was in Nashville visiting with the sisters, and they had me at one of their schools. They have a handful of schools there in Nashville where they have sisters assigned. And I was with an eighth grade class, and they had like submitted their questions before, and I was pulling out from like a bucket or a jug or whatever, like, and just answering random questions. And most of them were just silly. So it was like 90% silly and then 10% evangelical. I should say it's 100% evangelical with a 90% silly tinge. like one of the last questions they asked was, if you can meet like three famous people, who would you meet? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even like playing the pious fool, being like,
Well, I'll answer this question in a way you don't expect.
But I said, I'd like to meet Saint Jean de Brébeuf, Saint Maximilien mm-hmm. Kolbe, and Saint Thomas Aquinas. And these like eighth grade boys in the back, you know, like all of, 112 pounds, just flexing the whole day long, or like, wait, like, like saints? Like, yeah, like who would you meet?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's too funny. Like,
my famous people are terribly alive. They right. are, right. you know, kind of excellent human beings to the utmost extent. But okay. Right. So turning then to Edith Stein, this kind of encounter that you described was mediated specifically by her writings on women and this mm-hmm. idea of the feminine kind of soul, like feminine gestalt, mm-hmm. as it were. So is there a way in which to kind of encapsulate that teaching? Or do you think for people who aren't used to reading Edith Stein or might not have the background in scholastic mm-hmm. theology and mm-hmm. in kind of phenomenological philosophy, who might not necessarily gain easy access to the insights, can find inroads to the heart of the matter?
Mm-hmm. At the heart of her ideas about the feminine soul. Yeah, I mean, for what you'd have to think about with that part of her work is, it's probably easiest for somebody who's not really familiar. I mean, I don't think you need the phenomenology or the philosophy. This is somebody who, I mean, as a personal, her life, this is somebody who a lot of the external characteristics of her life would have looked pretty abnormal from the perspective of what was normal for the life of a woman in Germany at that time. And we, I think this is why she draws people. She was, this really excellent student. And at that time in Germany, she would have had as a young woman to have mastered, a lot of logic, a lot of linguistics, a lot of really dry material that it's not really great fun for anybody to do. Even very, very rare for a woman in her time to do that. She did not feel from a young age probably called to marriage and family life. But she obviously, reading her work, she had a very keen sense of a kind of the spirit of womanhood. So ultimately, cutting to the chase, what did she say? Well, she has this deep insight, which is that the essence of womanhood, the essence of being a woman, is a kind of spiritual nurturing, a kind of welcoming of the other person. And some of these words can sound really cliche and just kind of like, oh yeah, welcoming and, you know, hospitality and, you know, all, but actually she's going to get it there like pretty deep. But I think, so this idea that like, even if you don't necessarily have all the external signs of femininity, and we think about like all of our gender confusion today, but right, you maybe don't, you want to study something that's masculine. You want to become a philosopher. You don't think you're probably going to get married and have children, but those are just the philosophical accidents in a sense. Like, what's the core of being a woman? And so she just describes this with such precision and such kind of astonishing clarity that, it can one at the same time give you something to go after. You go like, oh, okay. So, you know, to what extent am I doing these things in my life? Like it's a thing that you are a woman, but it's also a goal, right? It's a goal to become more deeply a woman. So who you are. So she gives you this goal, right? Which is like to be warm and to be nurturing and essentially like if we were to boil it down, to see the potential for human perfection in another person and to nurture it, like to will it, to love it, to nurture it, to give it what it needs to grow. And so she talks about how, you know, you can't do that if you're too full of yourself. You kind of get in there and you get in the way, and you can't do it if you're yourself too immature. You have to be mature and in possession of your faculties. So it's this like really serious picture of what it would look like to orient your whole being to recognizing the possibility of perfection in another person and assisting it. Right. So what I've just described is something you can do regardless of whether you're called to get married and have babies per se. So I don't know if that's a good introduction. So what we in the tradition will call this spiritual motherhood, right?
Yeah. Okay. So against the backdrop of, okay, so let's think about it in these terms. I think sometimes a kind of masculine gestalt is sometimes described as a certain, yeah, like authority and or distance, which looks beyond particulars and makes decisions, difficult decisions, which might otherwise be difficult in light of some perceived common good or some perceived, you know, like goal to be pursued. So like the classic example being the general in the army. He knows that he's sending, you know, 12% of his soldiers to their death, but for the common good of the Republic, which he is defending against an unjust attack, he, while still, you know, having due affection for those in his care, sends them. And so it seems like the risk of, you know, a kind of masculine soul or masculine gestalt or quintessentially masculine virtues is a kind of negligence, you know, because it seems like on account of the fact that there is this authority cum distance, that one can excuse himself from involvement in the lives of others or from genuine solicitude for the good of others, such as, you know, how one might play out a kind of contrary to what you describe. Then with respect to what you describe, I think that a lot of people, no, maybe not a lot of people, but some people will describe the risk of having access to the inmost center of the person comes with it a great responsibility, because there is a risk then of like tinkering or manipulating, constantly taking the temperature so as to establish the basis of relationships which aim ultimately to be controlled. So it seems like what you're describing is kind of like tending unto a flourishing, tending unto a fulfillment, both for the woman and then for those whom she may or may not be, but may be called to, you know, kind of nurture in the way that you describe, but that there are these risks. So how might, you know, St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, or in your kind of explication of her, how might one, you know, cultivate the good aspects, minimize the bad aspects? I mean, how might one kind of perfect this with the cultivation of certain virtues?
Mm-hmm. Right. So she's pretty clear that she thinks none of this can really be perfected. Let's just say perfection is the other side of avoiding risks, right? She thinks none of this can be perfected apart from a pretty serious devotion to prayer and the sacraments. And she basically thinks, I think it's fair. I mean, I think we tend to be able to call our fellow, you know, as a woman, to call my fellow sisters in Christ to kind of a higher standard. When I see my husband as a father, he's tougher on the sons than I am, and I'm maybe tougher on the daughters. I think that Edith Stein as a thinker is, maybe she's a little tougher on the ladies, but she just kind of says, look, like, you can look in the world and you can find all kinds of distorted femininity. She does comment on exactly some of the risks you raise. She has a little extended couple of passages where she meditates on some of the work of Sigrid Undset, actually. It picks out some of the characters in those novels as examples of that, exactly the thing you just described, like womanhood that kind of is manipulative or maybe self-serving or something like that. But she's just kind of going to lay it bare, which is, I think, one reason she's not picked up by the feminists of the 20th century. And she says, you're going to avoid this by, well, number one, sort of recognizing you may have an unhealthy interest in people's inner lives, right? This is why she thinks women gossip too much. It's unhealthy interest in the lives of people. We can't mother, right? I mean, it's like, if somebody I've never met, but I want to read all about their relationships, like, that's twisted. But we all sort of have that inclination, right? Women especially. So she says, well, yeah, you got to know that that's going to be a problem. But then, like, she just cuts right to the chase. Look, you're going to find the capacity to direct this gift in the right way, like in front of the Blessed Sacrament. So it's like, she's not going to mess around on that one.
Yeah. Maybe at the end of the episode, I could get some hot takes on People magazine and Hallmark movies.
There we go. Yeah. Two probably abuses of this feminine genius. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay. Now, from what I understand, Edith Stein, when describing herself, you know, identifies some of these things, but she also thinks that she evinces kind of quintessentially masculine virtues. And certainly, like, in her biography, she's interested in, you know, like, philosophy, yeah, which qua profession is probably like 85% male dominated.
Yeah.
And she didn't seem to have an interest in marriage, and she, you know, like, is involved in various workplace relationships, some of which she suffered as a result of, you know, which,
yeah,
you know, she felt herself kind of ill-used by precisely on account of the fact that she wasn't a man. So, like, when we talk about quintessentially feminine, quintessentially masculine, is there a risk of falling into gender stereotypes that don't actually cut across the grain? Or is it a matter of, like, a kind of predominance of virtues that, I mean, you don't have to, like, wade into the whole feminist question, but, like, yeah, I think people are looking for clarity as to, right, like, what is meant, right, when we talk about these. Often enough in Catholic conversations, it gets in the direction of, you know, gender complementarity, but I don't, right, know what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I think it's worth spending a little time on the way she thought about it. I mean, I kind of touched on it before, you've touched on it. I mean, it seems clear that part of what she's up to is looking into the deeper meaning of our sexuality, our gender, so to speak. I've actually tried to make the defense we should go ahead and use the word gender. I know that a lot of the people who are sort of promoting, I guess we call it, like, sex realism in these debates about gender these days say, like, gender is sort of a silly term. We shouldn't use it. We should just always say sex. I kind of make the argument that I think there's something to what she's getting at. So she just says, look, first of all, like, you can't read her work on women and think, like, she doesn't have a handle on what's going on with women. She also spent time, I should say, like, although she's a philosopher and a very serious one, and she spent time as a Red Cross nurse in the First World War. She took care of her mom when she was home. She loved her mom a lot, even though she injured her mom greatly when she abandoned her Jewish faith as a young woman. So she's kind of complicated relationship, but she admired her mom a lot. So all that's just to say that she obviously appreciates what it means to be a woman deeply. And then actually, like, her descriptions of the vocation of woman, which she thinks of it as united. It's not like religious sisters are called to some other thing and women who are married are called to some other thing. She says, look, basically at the bottom of it all, the orientation of a woman is to achieve spousal union, right? And that spousal union is meant to be fruitful. And of course, like, the ultimate destiny of our soul, which is the vocation of the religious person, is to give witness to the destiny of the soul. She just thinks she's going to cut right to that place in life, and she's going to it's a great beauty. So when she describes what it means to be a bride of Christ, a spouse of Christ, as a woman religious, you can't doubt that she's in deep contact with her feminine nature, even though she might, I mean, certainly the pictures you see of her, most of them are not smiling. She did seem like a kind of a serious person. Maybe it's a good moment to just say she basically thought, look, there's three ways you participate in human nature. This isn't Thomistic. This is like her drawing up of like a kind of a quick taxonomy. She says, look, we're all human beings. And qua human being, we all have the same destiny, which is God. Or perfected human nature, she'll also say. She'll say perfected human nature, which is Jesus Christ. And then she'll say, but then we are man or woman. And if we're man or woman, that has a particular telos, right? So the telos of being a woman has a particular character to it. And that's essentially spiritual motherhood for a woman. And then that could take a variety of expressions, marriage and children, religious life for women. But she doesn't exclude that you could be single, working in the world and still live out this spiritual motherhood. But then she puts a lot of weight on number three, when she says it's just like all those accidents of your personality. So she gets a lot of variation, right? She can work with a lot of types of women in this framework, because she says, look, you could be a woman and called to spiritual motherhood, but you could have all these accidental characteristics or likes or dislikes that could put you in a box that makes you maybe even a little bit abnormal for a woman or a man. I think that threefold thing does a lot of work for her, and I think it's potentially freeing, understood properly. So there's obviously complete equality in the first category. We're all members of the human race with the same eternal destiny. Then you've got difference in that second category. And then you've got, she says, actually complete uniqueness in the third category. She says it's not possible to generalize about individual nature as you can generalize about perfected womanhood or perfected manhood. So she really wants to say, like, as individuals, there's something unique and unrepeatable and different that cannot be summed up. And it's okay if in your uniqueness, you do things that are maybe a little bit like abnormal or outside of the normal path for the cultural context.
Okay.
Yeah.
So presumably, St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross could not anticipate the current climate of what would we call it, transgender ideology or transgender confusion. I don't know that anybody could predict that in the 1930s and 40s, or maybe some people did. I read them all. How would you respond to someone who says, you know, we need to hold for X anthropology or Y anthropology, and definitely not Z anthropology, that is to say that of St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, because it seems like this notion of a kind of feminine soul and or masculine soul would, you know, kind of belie the type of thing for which we are advocating here, namely that, you know, biological species matters, and that the kind of specifying or determining factor of matter is paramount. You know, whatever somebody might argue, and along those lines, how do you volley back, or do you volley back?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not directly in those debates. Thankfully, that's someone else's job. I feel like that would be very depressing to have to spend all my time volleying back on that point. Can I say that?
Yeah.
But I think that we are not served in general by pretending as if it's not possible for us to keep two apparently contradictory truths in mind, right? And there's lots of aspects of human life that present to us things that seem contradictory, right? But they, we know in the light of faith, they're not. and the solution typically isn't to just deny one of them, right? And so what we're talking about here is maybe like the problem where we say, like, well, there's a truth about female nature, and there's also a truth about universal human nature, and that they're both true. Sorry.
You're good.
I think the best example of this, I think about the truth about Jesus Christ as a man. So he's a man. He's completely a man. He's completely God. And that doesn't seem very easy to figure out, right? And our faith doesn't say, like, yeah, actually, he's some kind of weird hybrid. He's not some middle ground. He's not half God, half man. What we're supposed to just wrap our heads around is, like, he's fully God and he's fully man. So we can be fully lots of things, but we are fully, I am fully a woman, but I'm fully a human being. And my telos as a human person, my end is God. And I share that with you, even though all of, you know, certainly many, maybe not all, but many of our accidents are very different. And our participation in sexual differentiation is completely different. So I think that we're not served in general by trying to oversimplify some of these things. It actually, like, young people and older people are actually able to sort of understand deeply that many aspects of the reality that God created, because he's a lot more interesting than we are, admit of these apparent contradictions. I mean, let's do free will for a minute. I mean, that you're the expert on that. So I'd go like, well, I can't even give you an accounting of free will. How is it possible that God has all this foreknowledge and I'm still free? I mean, right? Like, we could just pick through it, right? Our faith is riddled with these sorts of apparent contradictions. And we don't say, right, like, well, one half of this isn't true. And I think that's, for me, that's what I find in her work, right? Is like, well, okay, look, it could look like, suppose you have all these accidental characteristics that make you feel or look, do things that are a little bit more manly. That's fine. You could be that. Those are just accidents. It doesn't touch that you're still a woman and like, you're going to express this deep, I mean, she would actually say like the seed that's in you. So she likes these plant images and she would say, well, look, there's a seed of femininity in you. And if you have access to the things that feed your seed, like, okay, we're using these plant images, grace and the sacraments, whether you're a construction worker or an analytic philosopher, you are still going to have this progress towards perfected womanhood. Yeah. Is that freeing? I don't know. I think it's freeing. To me, it is. To me, it's freeing.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is always freeing. And my experience is, it seems like it's become more common in the 21st century to formulate an opinion on the basis of contrariety than on the basis of principles. Mm-hmm. So it's like, rather than be like, okay, right, these things are furnished by reason or these things are furnished by revelation, and I'm going to argue on the basis thereof in concert with the tradition in order to determine certain conclusions, which thereby, you know, kind of track with reality. It's more like, this person whom I don't like said X, so I'm going to say not X.
No, Father, you're not suggesting that our public discourse is like juvenile.
I would never suggest that, which is why when you push back against volley back as language, I was infinitely pleased, because I like to think of my engagements as mostly in the genre of whimsy rather than in the genre of argument.
Yeah. I think that's, listen. I think you're right.
I'm ready.
Certainly that's my view, right? Which is, certainly as a profession, my job isn't to be out there kind of fighting against people in different spaces. But more than that, like, I would have thought traveling for the TI to lots and lots of college campuses where I'm speaking under the banner of the feminine soul, what it could possibly be to have a feminine soul, I would have thought there'd be, I don't know, argument back and forth and a lot of maybe, and I found really basically none. And you know, you can add it up. You must have it somewhere. It's with a lot of campuses. I mean, it's at least 20 or 30 at this point, mostly, you know, big state schools. Why is that? And I think it's because, so you went with whimsy. I mean, that's fine. You go with whimsy. But I just say, look, I mean, here we have this like compelling person who wrote a lot of interesting stuff. And my job here isn't to kind of baptize it or say that it's true or not true. Let's just try to understand it. Right. And then just get like kind of work through it. And yeah, so I don't think of myself as making an argument in that sense. I'm not here to argue for her position. Obviously, I have a lot of sympathy with it. Right. But I'm not here to make an argument, just to like, let's just try to understand it. And I think that's been appealing to people, maybe not only because it's disarming, but also, as you say, people are sick of like everything's a culture war.
Yeah. I mean, this is to make a judgment for which I'm not myself, you know, fit, but it could also be like a matter of methodology. I've noticed that, you know, one makes arguments in the kind of classic sense of arguments, like clarifications or communal deliberations, on the basis of one's training. You're trained as an economist.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of what you're going to be doing is like gathering data, interpreting data, helping other people to interpret data so that way they can formulate policy.
Right.
So it's going to, you know, it's going to be getting you a certain disposition vis-a-vis the texts and then a certain disposition vis-a-vis the pedagogy. I am by training a teacher and a preacher of a different sort. And for me, the potential excess is demagoguery, because it's like revelation gives you infinite power. And there's a real risk of abusing that. It's like, I know everything always. And those who would say otherwise, I will fell. And I will, like, you know, stride over them, their fallen corpses like Colossus of old, which is, you know, it's a real risk. So I think that for me, like, the whimsy is in part to take the edge off the authority. But maybe I oughtn't to take the edge off an authority. I should just find ways in which to actually communicate with authority, which are more, yeah, paternal. Maybe that's, maybe to bring it back to Edith Stein, but like, I think that's like, I was ordained at the age of what, like 27, like a tall child.
Yeah.
And like, so spiritual paternity at like the beginning of my priesthood, I was like, what does that even mean? I'm like, right. I'm more of a crazy uncle than I am like a spiritual father. But yes. I, you know, like after however long, 10 years, it's like, yeah, I think it makes more sense now. So maybe that's part of the story as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. What do the kids say these days? I feel you. I mean, that was like, I became a mother to kids that were like half my age when I was 23. I was not as tall as you are, but I was definitely a young mother, right? I had no idea what to do, right? And yeah, today it feels natural and normal. But when I was 23, it did not feel natural or normal. And so you just, but what does it mean? It means you weren't a mother, or you weren't a spiritual father at the age of 27. No, like you were. You were just a young one, like not a super good one. You know, you were like, and I often talk to the kids who are around for that phase of my motherhood, and you're like, oh my, you know, I'm so sorry. I just like did everything wrong, right? The beautiful thing is, of course, like, there's some value in that, kind of recognizing that you grow. But yeah, 100%. Also, to your point about fatherhood, and I think as parents having little toddlers who then grow up, I mean, there are ways in which you become a better parent, and there are ways in which you become a worse parent. or you know, maybe that's just a funny way of highlighting, like, the things. There's like a season or something like that. So your oldest child, who's like the child of your young parenthood, like whoever you were teaching when you were 27, they'll look back and they'll think like, thank goodness, you know, father was this kind of a dad to us. And like, I see that, and you'll see those strengths. So like, my oldest has certain strengths and certain weaknesses, and the weaknesses are all our fault, you know, and the strengths, like, he was just born with them. But, you know, but the point is, an oldest child and a youngest child, like, probably destined by God or meant by God to look different. Because they're making us the parents we become in lots of ways, right? And and that's, like, it can't not be part of the plan, right? So,
yeah.
Right.
It's like, as you refine your soul craft, you also gradually give up.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there's no bedtimes in my house, by the way. Like, that is gone. Like, there's no routine. There's no bedtimes. We could list a lot of other things that we've let go of. Yeah.
Yeah. As could I. And I've only been a priest for 8 years. So the demands on my time and energy are far less significant and far less animate.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Yeah. Well, and returning to Edith Stein, I mean, remember that she wrote these essays on women largely because she was a teacher and at a Dominican school in Speyer for, I think, at least 8 years. I think it was about 8 years. So she was like where you are, reflecting on her maternity and watching the kids grow up and stuff. So yeah, I mean, look at the richness that's come out of that, right? She, like, you think like, well, where'd she get all this? I mean, it wasn't her philosophical interest actually to write about women or education. She did it because people wanted her to. Like, they said, could you give us a lecture about this? And she was known to be smart and interesting, so... But thank goodness, like, I don't think her philosophy is getting read as much today as her essays on women.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, my introduction to her, and we're kind of coming to the end now, but my introductions to her were largely the stories about the end of her life.
Yeah.
And as Solon says, call no man happy until he dies. Yeah. And if that's the criteria, then she died a very happy woman in the midst of bleakest of circumstances.
Right.
Because just like the testimony of the spiritual maternity that she exercised on her way to her death,
right,
like at the Vesterbork transit camp, and Yeah, I mean, like, it's just, it's astonishing.
It's astonishing.
The degree to which, yeah, she lived the things that she described without, like, a kind of overly conscious sense of the fulfillment of her own philosophy. It was just, like, it was philosophy of life, not in the cheap way in which that term covers phenomena in the early 20th century, but, like,
right,
it was just who she was, which is beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We are coming to the end of our time. Apropos of motherhood, mm-hmm. you wrote a book recently about motherhood. Can you say a word about that?
Sure. Yes, it's a book called, it's called Hannah's Children. And in fact, I'm proud to say, so Hannah's Children is the title of the book. Hannah refers to the biblical Hannah. Hannah is also the name of a character you meet in the book, and I'll tell you about it in a minute, but just to connect it to Edith Stein, a lot of readers of the book will notice that I do engage in my book a lot of biblical Hebraic ideas from the Hebrew scriptures about childbearing and about God's providence. And that's something I would really want to credit Edith Stein's, you know, maybe spirit or her prayers, right? Because she's somebody who's influenced me for such a long time. So I think she's got her fingerprints on this book. The book is called Hannah's Children, and it is really about the 5% of women in this country who have different family patterns from the standard, like get married late, if ever, and don't have any children, which is what 95% of people are mostly doing. The birth rate in the country right now is exceedingly low. It's catastrophically low. And there's lots of reasons for that. It's a really interesting and really tragic and heartbreaking phenomenon. But I had this thought, kind of an intersection of personal and professional interests about 6 years ago, that social science has largely developed as the social science of dysfunction. Like we study like broken homes and crime and poverty and these things that are not really like the vision of the creator for human life. And so I thought, well, you know, I know most people aren't having children, but there are a bunch of people having children, and they're not numerous by the country's standard, but there are 5% of us that are having kids. And so I thought, would it be possible to take a social scientist angle on this and go out and look at this group and describe them and gather data, try to interpret it, try to tell a story of like how I would interpret this with an economist's eye? And so that's what I did. So I went out and talked to a bunch of people, Jewish, Mormon, evangelical, mainline Protestants, Catholics, and collected up their stories, spent 3 years trying to figure out what it all meant. And then I put it together in a book, which is coming out next month.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Does your story feature in there at all, or do you omit yourself?
I mostly omitted myself. So you're aware. I mean, I tell right in the first chapter about kind of my own personal story, not in great depth, but enough to kind of get you started. Because I can't pretend like this book didn't come out of my personal experience. So I say it right up front. And then here and there, when I'm reacting to the things that the women say, you catch little bits from my story. But I just kind of worked with what felt natural. So the book is a kind of a moderately scholarly, but in normal like lay terms, introduction to kind of the problem, this birth rate problem and what we know about it. And then I just provide these case studies and try to interpret the case studies in light of other things that we know and draw some conclusions about what it might take to kind of... So the fundamental question is like, do these people like me and like maybe other people that you know... are they kind of irrelevant for this modern problem of collapsing family? Like they're just kind of religious nuts out there doing their thing, right? Or is this in the best sense that we would, is there a way to describe this as totally rational behavior, right? And if so, what are the things they would have to think and believe and practice? What kind of habits would they embody? That's where you'd go, okay, well, okay, so we can't, you know, we can't just order up more of these people. But if you're going to design policy, what would you want to think about if this is actually a really important story? So of course I make the case it's a really important story, and I try to suggest like maybe which direction I think policy might be best directed. So the spoiler alert is I think it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to raise the birth rate by more or less paying people to do so. Like people create incentives to do direct incentives to have more babies. But I do think if we can make more space for the church, and that's a task for policymakers, is to think about ways they might be crowding out the work of the church, or maybe try to dial some of that back. Although we know that like people don't like policy recommendations that start with, okay, cut this, like cut spending on this, stop doing this. But yeah, that's the book. So I'm really excited about it. But yeah, it's, I mean, you're not wrong. Like this, in a sense, like comes right out of this early interest in trying to reveal to people, trying to help reveal the mystery of what it means to be a woman, which sounds also kind of cheesy right now. But like, you know, there's all these jokes like men don't understand women and women don't understand women. But there's like a work to be done there. And So it's a little stab at that.
Cool.
Yeah. Hey. It's great.
But in the end, God understands women. So
I don't know.
As long as you've got that backstop.
Let's say, then... yeah, let's say that's right. I mean, right. It's interesting, right? Like our marriages will fall away, right? And all these things of this world will fall away. But our maleness and our femaleness won't fall away, as I understand it. I mean, the Blessed Mother won't cease to be the Blessed Mother, right? And Jesus Christ won't cease to be the man, Jesus Christ. It's important to think about what glorified, perfected womanhood is like, right? Because that's how we're going to be forever. And it's going to be pretty interesting. And probably we get glimpses of it today, but we probably don't anticipate the full glory of it. So I think it's like, it's not like other things that are temporal that are passing away. That's not worth thinking about this.
Yeah. Like a dumpster fire in a cave.
Dumpster fire in a cave. Instance. Correct. Yeah, correct. Well, thanks
good.
A lot.
Well, yeah. My joy. Thanks so much for taking the time. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hope to see you again, either here or in person soon.
Yep. Since we are not too far afield, I think I'm doing something over at CUA next week. And then presumably I'll be doing something at CUA for the rest of my life in small portions or snatches.
You probably will be.
I look forward to seeing you at one or two.
Yeah, I'll probably be at part of that panel or maybe most of it. The book that you guys are discussing, which I haven't read, but it's written by a good friend who used to teach her.
That's awesome.
And I'm probably supposed to know what's in a book, but I'll just wait to the panel. Did you read it?
Yeah, I would admit to similar things on the air, but I don't want the record of those to exist ad aeternitatem. So at the time of the actual panel itself, I'll make that judgment. So Lord, save us from overly busy schedules. Amen.
Oh my goodness. Amen.
Amen.
Yeah. Amen.
All right. Turning to you then, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Off-Campus Conversations on the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet subscribed, whether on YouTube or on your podcast app, please do so. So that way we can be in your ear or before your eyes with greater frequency. Unless that's not good for you, and then don't bother, and then just watch and or listen whenever it suits your fancy. Or quit it entirely and enjoy more silence in your life. We support all things which conduce to spiritual growth, even when it means no longer checking in. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.